The content here is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice.
Please consult a healthcare professional with any medical questions and concerns.
If you are experiencing an emergency or need immediate help, call 911.
In no way does listening, reading, emailing, or interacting on social media with our content establish a therapeutic relationship.
I just get so angry. It's hard to sit still.
I don't want to be this way.
My brain just feels all scrambled.
We are continuing our deep dive into ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. This is episode 58, How to Diagnose ADHD. I'm Chad Douglas alongside Nikki Shields, and we welcome back Dr. Tanya Royster, who is a psychiatrist that specializes, in ADHD, or I'm sure you specialize in a bunch of stuff since you focus on the brain. So you're the doctor and I'm the guy in the basement that records podcasts. So we were talking about how to diagnose. If you missed the last episode, it's all about explaining ADHD. So you might want to go back and listen to that one first. You don't have to, you know, if you're pretty sure it's in your family, you can listen to how to diagnose it. So here we go. Let's talk about how to do it. We mentioned some of the symptoms and signs in the last episode. So when it comes to a professional such as yourself, how do you diagnose someone with ADHD?
Yeah, so this is really important because a lot of times people will self-diagnose, right? they heard about it on TV, they looked at it on the internet, or a teacher mentioned it to them, which, by the way, is illegal. But a lot of times teachers recommend that parents get treatment. ADHD and most mental health disorders are clinical diagnoses. That means that a professional, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, uses their clinical knowledge and collects information, historical, behavioral, social, emotional, to understand the behaviors, the collection of behaviors that a person is exhibiting. And then based on their broad knowledge of emotional behavior norms and abnormals, they make a clinical diagnosis. ADHD is one because it is very heavily driven by externally observed behaviors. Mm-hmm. We see the child bouncing all over the place. We see them not being able to stay on task. We see their poor frustration tolerance. Because we can see those things, it's very heavily determined on that. There are other disorders like anxiety or depression that are predominantly internal, right? Where it's how you feel, what's happening on the inside. There may be some external manifestations, but the bulk of those disorders are internal. So it's a clinical diagnosis. Now we have tools, right? So it's not just necessarily a doctor and you chatting. I have, you know, my own kind of after 25 years of doing this, my own little internal checklist, but there are actually published checklists, right? Okay. And so a lot of times you may have a pediatrician use some of the simple screening tools, we call them the Conners, the Vanderbilt. These are very common in communities. And the pediatrician may give it to you. They'll give a copy to the child if the child is old enough. They'll give a copy to the parent, and they'll give a copy to a teacher or like a Sunday school teacher, some other third external adult figure who can observe the child and comment on their behavior. And it asks you to rate this child's behavior as, you know, on a scale from not a problem at all to this is very problematic for this child. So that assumes that the adult that's filling it out has enough knowledge about, you know, children that they can say this is a problem or not. And then the child who fills it out that's older, it asks them, is this a problem for you? So those are some simple tools that we use to assist us. Then if you're really fancy, you can use a neuropsychologist, and they use a battery of tests that really examine how quickly does the brain respond to information? How many mistakes does the brain make? Why is the brain making these kind of mistakes? And they also take a history and, you know, from birth all the way up and what's going on in the family. And they compile all that information, and they also can come up with ADHD. So the diagnosis can be very easy or very complex, but the result is the same. It's an observation of behaviors and patterns of behaviors that tell us that this person has this set of symptoms. They fall, as we talked about in the last category, on the last episode, in three categories. So the symptoms are inattention or lack of focus. The symptoms fall under the category of hyperactivity, or a lot of times people say fidgetiness, running like a motor. Or the third is impulsivity or poor impulse control. And I always tag on the fourth cousin, low frustration tolerance, right? That's listed as a behavior, but it's so prominent in children with ADHD that I think that people forget, you know, if you are trying to do something and you keep getting off track, you get frustrated. And then that can make you be irritable, or that can make you be aggressive, as we say, you know, have meltdowns or have behavior problems. And then those are the kind of things that often get misdiagnosed, right? It all stems for, that's where the clinical knowledge and the clinical ability to understand how do we put the pieces of the puzzle together is what makes a person a clinical expert in being able to diagnose.
So does it have to be a clinical expert? You can't have a primary physician give a diagnosis of ADHD. They would have to refer to a specialist?
So you absolutely can. And if they have enough experience and they feel comfortable and confident, because the pattern, particularly for what I call bread and butter ADHD, you got a 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old who's hyperactive, can't focus, lose it. Like they're like, you tick them off like that. Mm-hmm. Primary care doctors are excellent at that. When it gets a little more complicated, particularly when we get into the low frustration tolerance, the poor impulse control, the meltdowns, that's usually where the primary care doctor is like, let me get my friend, the child psychiatrist over here.
Yeah.
Primary care physicians treat 80% of the kids who have ADHD.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So they only come to me when it's not working.
Okay.
Right. A lot of times primary care doctors have, you know, they can pick it up pretty quickly and they know what's step one. And if step one doesn't work, they're like, they don't want to muck around. And I don't blame them. I'm glad that they do refer them over to us. And then we really say fine tune. Well, you know, step one, you know, let's tweak it a little bit. You know, we're respectful of our colleagues who are doing a very, very good job covering a whole lot of things.
Which is probably helpful with such a wait list for mental health treatment, that's nice that the primaries can do that.
Absolutely. And like I said, and you know, it really depends. Some primary care physicians are very, very comfortable and they will treat everybody with ADHD. And other ones are like, the moment they see the behaviors, they refer. And then some people, if the kid is 8, 9, or 10, they're comfortable. But if the kid is 5 or 6, they're not comfortable. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, talk to your primary care doctor, and if they're not comfortable, ask them to refer you to somebody who is. It's okay that they're not ready to treat that, but just ask them to refer you to someone who can help.
One of the things I want to talk about in this episode is how, for those more complicated cases, right? The ones that where it's not working, what the primary care physician is not doing, or what they are doing is not getting the results that they're looking for, and they are referred to you. What kinds of things can complicate matters? Why doesn't primary care treatment tend to work for all of the kids?
Well, the most common reason that the primary care initial treatment doesn't work is that the kid has comorbid disorders. That means they have something else going on. As we said in the last episode, 40% of the time, a child or adolescent will also have some anxiety or some depression. And so when you add that into the ADHD, it might be that the stimulant is working or the treatment is working, but the anxiety then gets, you know, we say unmasked, but it's not that it's unmasked. It's just that the behavior was so bad, we didn't even notice that they were anxious, right? And so a lot of times people will mistake that and say, oh, the ADHD treatment caused my anxiety. No, if I did a really thorough evaluation, which I always do, if I did a really thorough evaluation, I would know that. Now, a primary care doctor doesn't have the knowledge to do as thorough of an evaluation. So they're going to pick up the rough, rudimentary, basic, like ADHD, and then they may not be able to have the skills or knowledge to really go further and understand if there are comorbidities. The other thing that oftentimes may make the initial treatment pass by the primary care ineffective is if the kid has medical issues, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of healthcare issues that interfere and medicines that intersect with the things that we do in mental health for the brain. And so any other comorbid condition, it could be mental health, it could be physical health. If there are psychosocial stressors in the family, that's a big one, right?
What's that?
Psychosocial stressors.
I'm going to take notes.
Are basically problems.
Okay.
Fancy way of saying problems.
We're not the only ones that are fancy, Dr. Royster. Right? You are as well. Yeah. Listen to this vernacular we have going on.
Yeah. The fancy word for problem. So, you know, if I have a parent that I spoke to today, and I had an appointment with her child 13 days ago. And she was like, everything is great. She's doing well, blah, 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 blah. Then she called me today and she said, the last 4 days have been terrible. We need to change her medicine. You know, something's going on. I said, hold on a minute.
How'd you get this number? And
no, 13 days ago, she was doing fantastic. So something happened, right? And kids don't always have the language to tell us things, but their behavior will always tell us things.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, did something happen at home? Did something happen at school? Did something happen on the bus? Like, we start to go through the checklist. And a lot of times parents are like, oh, nothing happened. And then I'll just start asking the questions and they go, well, you know, my mother moved in and her dad moved out and, you know, we got a new dog and I found out I'm pregnant. And I'm like,
you know,
nothing happened. So just like we react to stress, children react to stress, but they don't have the words. I saw a 17-year-old today and he said, I just don't have the words. I don't know what's happening. I just know I have a lot of emotions and I don't know what to do with them. Right. And that's pretty sophisticated.
Yeah. I was like, good for
right?
him, for her.
So younger children don't even have those words. So it's just going to come out. I always tell parents, think about when your baby was one or two before they had language. How did they get your attention? They hit you. They screamed. Uh-huh. They cried. They did things. They used their behavior to express what was going on inside, and you were like a detective. Do you need a new diaper? Do you need this? Are you hungry? Are you sleepy? Right? Well, that's what happens with kids who have ADHD and everything else as well. If they don't have the language, then the treatment that we expect to produce a certain effect may not. So children who have speech and language delay can really, really look like ADHD and be misdiagnosed. And that's one of the things that I pick up all the time. Get a speech and language eval. It could very much be that they need speech therapy and not treatment for ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Or occupational therapy. I know.
Or occupational therapy.
Said that. So how often do you feel ADHD is misdiagnosed?
Oh, phew.
Every day?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure every day. I was like, I couldn't even imagine a percentage. So many times, I think because it is, you know, a popular diagnosis now. And, you know, the good news is people are much more willing and able to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. But they get a lot of their information from not the best sources, right? And, you know, I love parent chat rooms and I love parent Facebook groups and I love, you know, all these websites. But they are not the same thing as having a conversation with a clinician who can really help you tease apart what's going on, help you make an accurate diagnosis. Anybody on any given day can look like the worst of the psychiatric disorders, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just the human condition. And so it's really important to remember that the diagnosis includes a set of symptoms that are in a consistent pattern that, number one, have lasted at least 6 months, started in early childhood, and interfere with their social, academic, psychological, relational functioning, right? So they could be just as spastic if they want, but if it isn't causing them any problems, then technically it's not ADHD.
Interesting.
Right? So the diagnosis requires not only a set of symptoms, not only over a set of time, also in more than one setting. So anytime I had a kid recently, the mom was like describing classic ADHD. And then I said, well, what does the teacher say? And she says, oh, the teacher doesn't say much. That's a clue, right? Teacher always has something to say. Yeah. So we sent home a rating scale screener to the teacher and the teacher scored him normal. Not a single concern. So the mom said, oh, she doesn't know him very well. She's only had him for a little while. I'm going to give it to last year's teacher. She scored him normal. Not a single problem. So if it's not happening in more than one setting, then it's not that diagnosis. There's something going on in that environment where the problem is occurring that we need to look at. But if it's not generalized to all settings, then it's not ADHD.
Which is where the lines probably get blurred between the anxiety and the other conditions that we've spoken about.
Yeah, all conditions should be affecting you in all environments, right? You might be more comfortable at home, but the moment, you know, mom goes into the other room, the anxiety is going to kick up, or the moment you try to go to sleep, or, you know, so even anxiety, depression, whatever, they should all happen in more than one setting. But for ADHD, it is required that they happen in more than one setting, because as we just talked about, behavior is a child's primary way of expressing themselves when words fail them. If a child is having behavior problems at home, it might be there's something going at home and not ADHD. So we need to check and see, is it happening in other environments, to see is it intrinsic to the child like ADHD, or is it in the environment?
So it is not situational. I will cross that off my list of questions to ask.
Yes.
Do you ever find that parents are actually disappointed to find out that their child doesn't have ADHD? And why? Yeah.
So, you know, so for a wide variety of reasons, but most common is they know that ADHD is highly treatable. And so if it's not ADHD, then it's not the child, then what is it? Right.
Now,
and they certainly don't want to think that it's them. Right. No. They certainly don't want to think that it's the parent-child behavior problem. Sometimes, like today, I saw a little boy, he clearly has ADHD, but he and the parents were like, it's causing impairment, but it's not causing enough impairment. And I said, that's a personal decision.
Yeah.
Right. So if you feel like, keep struggling, let me know when you're ready. I'm over here. Mm-hmm. I'll be here when you're ready. I'm not forcing, you know, I tell people all the time, I don't get paid by the pill, right? I get paid to offer you advice and sound information and good choices and to support you in whichever decision you choose. A lot of parents are relieved that it's not, a lot are disappointed that it's not, but most of the time they just want an answer, right? And they have their worst fears. A lot of times, almost all the time, parents are like, yeah, I have ADHD, so this isn't a surprise. I just kind of was hoping it wouldn't be, but, you know. And it also happens the other way. I have quite a few parents that have said, as I've watched you treat my child and talk to my child about the symptoms and the impairment, I realize I've had ADHD.
Yeah.
And can I get an evaluation?
Yeah.
So it is just because a parent didn't know they had it as a child, a lot of times they learn through their own child and seeing their child improve with treatment. And they're like, oh my God, like I needed this my whole life. I never knew.
And it can be life-changing. And I've shared through this podcast a lot about my son's, that's the whole reason this podcast was born, about his journey in mental health. And when he got his ADHD diagnosis, his was, you'd mentioned before about it being that it covered the anxiety. His was the opposite. He had so much anxiety that it was, the ADHD was taking a back seat. And once we got that diagnosis and got treatment, I mean, big change. Next day, it was like a light switch went on. And so my wife and I were excited that we got it, because it's just like that. It's like we're getting answers now. So we're on the path to improving. So I want to know too, because again, started all because of my son. How serious do you think ADHD is taken in today's society?
Oh, that's such a tricky question, because it's like one of those things that has become so common that it's like seriously not serious, and people kind of make fun of it. They kind of joke about it.
Yeah.
But it is a real disorder with real consequences. And we know from years of study that people who don't get treatment have poor outcomes in their life. They have more incarceration. They have more issues with substance abuse. They have more unstable long-term relationships. Like, all of this has been borne out for decades and decades. We don't want to take it lightly, but I think sometimes when it becomes too common, everybody's like, oh, it's just ADHD.
Right.
Right. Oh, it's just, oh, you can, that's easy. You can deal with that. And it's like, no, it causes impairment. It causes harm. It causes challenges that need support. And some school districts are great. Some teachers are great. Some are not, right? So that's the other thing that makes it challenging. You know, sometimes a teacher will be like, well, my son had ADHD, so you'll be fine. And other people are like, well, my son had ADHD, so I'm here to help you, you know? And so the very same circumstance can produce different outcomes in people. So it's like, I'd say it's a seriously unserious. It's almost become so common. It's like when we use the words, I think this is one of the challenges of mental health, because the words that we use in our professional clinical opinion are very common everyday language, like anxiety, depression, they get watered down the significance of them. So people forget that ADHD is an important disorder, very, very treatable, that has significant lifelong consequences if we don't take care of it. It just becomes this thing that everybody's comfortable with.
Just as an opinion, Dr. Royster, and I think, Nikki, you and I talked about this in an earlier episode, and it's the A.A. Milne, Winnie the Pooh, that each character represents a different mental health condition. And I sit there and go, ADHD, I remember, was Tigger. I think Winnie the Pooh was depression. And I'm not overly familiar with Winnie the Pooh. He was never one of my people, my things. But maybe Piglet was anxiety. I mean, any thoughts?
Eeyore was depression.
How did I think Winnie the Pooh? He had an eating disorder. Eeyore's my favorite out of there, even though I'm not overly familiar with. Any thoughts on pop culture and how it portrays ADHD and anxiety and depression?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exactly, you know, like we're just talking about, because it is so common, you know, you will probably hear it talked about in a sitcom or a drama or, you know, some medical show. They either will over-dramatize it, you know, which isn't good, or they will minimize it, which isn't good, right? And so, you know, it's very hard to find realistic portrayals of mental health and emotional challenges in the media. And so what we get are these either fantastical things or totally ignoring the significance of those things. Sometimes I'll watch a movie or something, I'll go, that would never happen. And then I can't watch the rest of the movie because I'm so caught up on, that's just not the way it works for people, right? And so it absolutely has an impact. People get their internal baseline of what to think about life, about disorders, about everything, from TV, from media. It's a powerful tool, but it's also a dangerous weapon, right? And so if ADHD is not seriously portrayed in any of these types of settings, then we will get the wrong idea. A lot of times I've seen a couple of shows where they talk about people abusing the treatment, right? So then what's the consequence of that? People don't want to put their kids on treatment that could end up being abused, right? Yeah. And so it may make a great storyline, but it's like irresponsible in some ways. And, you know, it's not like the media ever said they were going to be responsible. It's irresponsible to have these things. I remember back in, you know, old days, like the 90s. That's my old days. But like when they would at least try to tackle some of these things, they would at least take the last minute of the show and say, hey, this is a serious issue. If you need help, blah, 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 blah. But now, you know, I think about even like the cartoons like South Park or other things like these are satire. And so they don't take the time to really tease this apart. But children and families are watching these things and they're not saying, oh, this is satire, right? No. They're saying, oh, that character had ADHD or that character had depression or anxiety. And so that's what it looks like.
Yeah, it's like when Jesse Spano got addicted to caffeine pills on Saved by the
Bell. Yes, exactly. Like,
funny, it's easy to look at the cheesiness, but if you look at like kind of the underlying theme there of like, this is a very serious issue, and this sitcom on Saturday mornings tackled it in a way that children could understand, that, but then it's also up to the parents to have that conversation of going, okay.
Exactly. And they encourage that.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was also one where they did the PSA with There's No Hope with Dope. Okay. Yeah. I really like Saved by the Bell.
It's like our fifth reference to Saved by the Bell in the podcast ever. So we're racking them up there. I was just going to ask, what do you wish parents understood? Like, what is the one thing that you wish that the parents of the kids that you work with understood about this diagnosis and what it means for their kids?
I really wish their parents understood that this is not their child, right? This is a set of behaviors. It is highly treatable. Now, am I going to tell you that every child is going to immediately respond? No, but the vast majority of children are going to have what feels like miraculous response in very short order. And so treatment is effective. Treatment is available. And so the goal of treatment is to let your child be their best self.
Yeah.
You know, so many parents have the fear, oh, my baby's going to become a zombie. I hear that mm-hmm. all the time, mm-hmm. even today. Like, you know, you think like that's an old misconception. No, that's still very, very prevalent.
Wow.
And the first thing I say to them is, I don't want that either. Like, I'm not trying to produce a world of zombies. Like, that's not my goal. My goal is for these symptoms to be alleviated so your child can be your child.
Yeah.
You can go back to enjoying your child instead of being frustrated and angry and, you know, sometimes, quite frankly, hating your child. Mm-hmm. Right. And
well,
so
that's
deep.
Yeah,
it's true, though. It's so true. And so it's a reminder to parents that this is not your child. And once they are treated, give them the grace and give them a chance again, because, mm-hmm. you know, parents are people, too. And, you know, they'll be like, well, he did this. And I'm like, well, number one, he's six. Number two, that was his ADHD symptoms. Yeah. So that's not who he is as a person. We're treating the symptoms so you can allow who he is to shine.
Nice. So let's talk about that, because, I mean, you're really tapping into the parent-child relationship. And mm-hmm. and I have a child with ADHD. She was diagnosed when she was 8 and she's 15 now. And I can say that, like, it has strongly impacted our relationship in mm-hmm. many, many ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I'm just curious, what do you see? What do you see in parent-child relationships when it comes to a diagnosis of ADHD?
I think ADHD can be one of the most detrimental things to the parent-child relationship, because if you think about it, when a parent has a child, all they think about is how much fun they're going to have with that kid. Yeah. I'm going to love this kid. We're going to do this together. We're going to do that together. Like, all they think about is all the happy things that they're going to do with that child. And then ADHD steps in.
Reality steps in. I didn't know the poop went up the back out of the diaper. Yeah. That was something you learned.
Boots
on the ground, right?
Yes, boots on the ground. But when ADHD interferes, like, you can't go out to a restaurant because you're chasing the child all over the restaurant. So you're like, I can't have fun anymore. You know, like, you're constantly saying, stop. You're constantly saying, don't do that. Come back over here. You're constantly having to repeat yourself when a child has ADHD. And so all those things start to chip away at a parent's fondness mm-hmm. for their own child, right?
Yeah.
And suddenly their child is a person they don't want to be around. And that sucks, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Then you're guilty, you're angry, you're mad, and you're still got to deal with this kid, right? And
I cannot imagine what that must be like.
This is brand new information.
So that's why I always tell parents, once we're on the road to recovery, I want you to start dating your child again. And I oftentimes will assign parents, once a month, you have to go out on a mommy-daughter date or a daddy-daughter date or some whatever the configuration needs to be, in order to not talk about school, you just go have fun, you go do something. There's lots of low-cost, no-cost opportunities to enjoy time together. And get to reconnect and remember who this little person was that you fell in love with, right? And then these symptoms created this huge cloud that took that away from you. And so you have to rebuild that bond. And the child has to trust you as well, because you spent the last 3 years telling them, no, stop, don't. And then you just suddenly expect to have like a great relationship with them.
Right. So this question was just emailed in from a listener, for either one of you. So how do you do that as a parent? Because you've parented the last year mm-hmm. of doing that. No, don't do this, blah, blah, blah. And then, because you didn't want to set them off for a meltdown. Mm-hmm. So now you're getting the treatment, but you're still kind of parenting that way because you're trying to prevent a meltdown. Mm-hmm. How do you get past that roadblock? Thank you, listener, for that question.
You just have to be committed to do it. You have to trust yourself. You have to trust your child. And nobody's going to be perfect. Like, they're going to mess up. You're going to mess up. But you got to give them the grace and give them the chance and the opportunity to rise, and you as well. Right.
Yeah.
Especially as children with ADHD, you know, this is the time of year where kids are signing up for driver's ed because next year. And it's like, if you have a kid with ADHD, can you imagine the thoughts that, that go through your head? Right. And so it's like, you have to trust. And then you also use that as a teaching thing. You know, I tell parents, like, everything you do as a parent is really preparing them for life, right? Yeah.
I tell my kids that all the time. My job is to make you a productive adult in society.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And once they get into the quote unquote real world, nobody's going to give them everything just because they want it or just because they're nice. They're going to have to work for it. They're going to have to earn it. And so it's okay to implement that in your home too. Mm-hmm. But the sooner you do that, the easier it is. I always tell parents, you can't let your child get away with everything until they're 13 or 14 and then decide you want to start parenting them. That's not going to work.
You can do that, but yeah, the outcome is not pretty.
Yeah, no. I'm going to write a book.
What not to do?
Yeah. I'm going to call Oops, I Did It Again. Oh, wait, I probably can't. That's probably copyrighted.
They've taken that, yeah.
But yeah, it is hard, and it just takes trust. And, you know, whoever is your village, if you have a partner, if you have a spouse, that person supports you. You guys tap out and work together. But it's hard. But it just takes a lot of courage.
And I've said before on previous episodes, talking to your child, not as if they're an adult, but having conversation with the child. Mm-hmm. Like, I like to think I've got a great relationship with both of my children, because with my oldest, I laid down, thanks to some therapy and some advice there, of just saying, you know what, I screwed up there. That was on dad. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you have that where when you admit fault and they see you as a human, it doesn't necessarily level the playing field, but it lets them look at you in a different light. And it's life-changing. At least it was for me.
I always say the greatest gift you can give your child, well, two. One is their imagination. The other is to let them see your humanity. Apologize to your child. It lets them know, hey, if dad's not perfect, I don't have to be perfect, right? Mm-hmm. If mom's not perfect, I don't have to be perfect, right? So let them see your humanity. Apologize when you make a mistake. Explain why you were wrong. You know, in child-specific terms, depending on how old they are, but let them see you as a human. It will be the best thing for them as they try to figure out how to be a human.
Yeah, I agree, because I've seen it happen just upstairs. was not on a TV show. How does technology contributes to ADHD, if at all?
Yeah, so technology doesn't contribute to ADHD. It does contribute to violence and aggression and stuff like that. There's been plenty of things like that. But no, that's not the reason. It was here long before we had technology. You know, the old prior name, the original name of ADHD was minimal brain dysfunction. So that was way before technology, right? So technology didn't create, didn't enhance, didn't increase. It is just another thing that we deal with in today's world.
So when you have people, and this kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier about joking about it, you know, if you get a text and I'm as guilty as the next person, I'm looking at my watch going, who texted me? I'm still listening to the conversation, but depends on what the text says, I might tune out and read the text as opposed to listening to the conversation. Stuff like that doesn't contribute to more people thinking they have ADHD.
No, I don't think so. And actually, the opposite happens. A lot of times, people mistake the fact that people can focus on technology as a sign that the person doesn't have ADHD. And I always have to correct them. When you're focusing on technology, you are constantly getting bombarded with information, right? Technology is not static. So when you're playing a video game or watching a TV show, there's all kinds of sensory inputs and your brain is not focusing on one thing. It's darting all over the place and it's happy, right? So that's actually proof that, you know, that they that doesn't prove or disprove ADHD, but it's not. Certainly a lot of times parents will say, well, they have AD, they can't focus on anything except that video game. And I'm like, well, they're not really focusing on a video game either, right?
Okay, there's
so much happening in the sounds, the lights, the movement. You're providing tactile, like there's so much activity in a video game. That's not like focusing on one thing at all, right? So there's no way you could swap that out for reading a book.
Yeah. And newsflash, technology is not going anywhere.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted, and this is, I should have mentioned this earlier, but going back to diagnosing ADHD, when my son was diagnosed with it, I was like, there's no way, because he's not overly hyper. That's what I thought it was. Mm-hmm. And the person who diagnosed him said, but inside his brain, and I love this analogy, that's why I want to share it. It's like somebody's got a TV remote and they're just constantly clicking channels. It's like his brain is hyperactive. His body's not, but his brain is. And I just thought that was something I just wanted to bring up for folks.
Yeah. And then just most people have some combination, some degree of all of the ADHD symptoms. It's very, very, very rare for a person to have none of the hyperactive and only have inattention or only have poor impulse control. Usually, if you look closely enough, you will see those other symptoms, just maybe not causing as much problems, but they're always there.
Fantastic stuff, Dr. Royster. We appreciate your time with us. We have one more episode with Dr. Royster's time, and we're going to do that in a couple of weeks, and it's going to be on treatment. So that's going to be a pretty exciting one too. Again, we appreciate when you share this with folks who you think could hear it. And I think there's probably a lot of folks out there that could benefit from this little series on ADHD. So we appreciate you sharing that. Giving us some positive reviews on Apple Podcasts. It does help. Our whole goal in starting this podcast was to start a conversation, and that conversation continues with you.